All right.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world, and happy Thursday, everybody. Today is July 9th, 2026. And our top story this morning, European automakers are dying. Now, look, the whole auto industry is in trouble. U.S. automakers, Chinese automakers, God knows the Japanese have had plenty of problems over Nissan and everything going there. But it is a particular brand of misery for the European automakers going on this morning. Now, yesterday we talked about Mercedes and how Mercedes sales were taking a dive, in particular in China. They were in big trouble. They did show some pockets of strength in North America, but for the most part, Mercedes posted some pretty lousy numbers. And then today, we've got the same thing from both Porsche and Volkswagen. Porsche first half sales were the weakest in 6 years, down 16% from where they were a year ago. And that weakest in 6 year number doesn't really do it justice, because remember, 6 years encapsulates COVID, when everybody was like illegal to leave your freaking house. So you definitely weren't buying a Porsche if you weren't allowed to go anywhere in 2020. So take that out. This is the worst numbers they've put up in quite a while. In particular, those numbers in China are very, very bad for Porsche. Now, what is going on with these European automakers? What's causing these problems? Well, before we get into that, let's talk about Volkswagen too. Article this morning, Volkswagen is getting ready, gearing up for a big fight with their union. Now, Volkswagen was already in the process of cutting 50,000 jobs as part of a deal that they negotiated with their union back in 2024. They're going to cut 50,000 jobs, but they said, we're not going to close any plants. Now, Volkswagen wants to cut 100,000 jobs and completely shut down three plants. And of course, the union is fighting them on it. Oh, and by the way, Volkswagen owns three quarters of Porsche. So the news just keeps getting worse for them. So what's killing the European auto industry in particular? Well, there are three things. Number one, you've just got your cost of doing business in Europe is obscenely high. Your compliance costs, your overregulation, think California, but even worse. It's just next to impossible to run a manufacturing business in Europe of any kind. On top of that, you've got U.S. tariffs. That sure as hell are not helping. All right, the tariffs that President Trump put after Liberation Day last year on the auto industry, they're taking a big chunk out of sales in Europe's biggest market, the United States. Now, the big thing, though, yeah, the tariffs is hurting. The cost of business in Europe is hurting. But what's really killing these businesses is Chinese dumping mass-produced electric vehicles all over their market. The Chinese, remember, they were producing so many of these cars at such a loss that the Chinese government had to order their car makers to stop doing it because their suppliers weren't getting paid. They were worried about factory workers not getting paid because BYD and all these Chinese EV makers just weren't paying anybody. And row after row, fields of these cars produced at a loss. The Chinese started to worry about deflation. They started threatening automotive executives. So what did they do? Well, they started to export the cars. They just dumped them in overseas markets. And we saw that yesterday when we reported how Chinese auto sales were way down year over year. I forget the number off the top of my head. I think it was like 23% decline year over year in car sales. Actually, let's get that number right. I've got right here in my notes. China's auto sales, yeah, it was 23% decline year over year. But they made up for that with a 150% increase in exports. They have just dumped those cars into any market that will have them. And Europe is already struggling with tariffs, already struggling with the cost of doing business there. They just can't survive that. And so we've got this news from Porsche and Volkswagen this morning that is indicative of what's going on there. Now, the other big story, unfortunately, bombs, missiles, and drones are flying again over the Strait of Hormuz. That started up yesterday. It has continued through the night. More attacks. We've got some rail bridges and road bridges were hit in Iran, along with coastal military targets. The Iranians are retaliating against U.S. bases in the region. But despite all that, and traffic in the Strait of Hormuz has ground to a near halt, a few ships might be sneaking through with their transponders turned off, but there's almost nothing on marine traffic. But take all that with a grain of salt, because the price of oil is actually down 80 cents a barrel this morning, at least as of when I hit record button. Why is the price of oil down? Because President Trump was on Air Force One and he said Iran called and they want to make a deal. We don't know who it was, just Iran called, you know, phone number come in, oh, spam risk. No, we're not going to take that one. Oh, Iran calling. Let me go ahead and take that call. Iran wants to make a deal. They didn't say who in Iran. Was it the speaker of their parliament? Was it their president? Was it the Ayatollah who may or may not be alive, Schrodinger's Ayatollah? Or was it the IRGC who is really the power in Iran right now and does whatever the heck they want, regardless of what the negotiators come up with at the table? President Trump said a thing. They want to make a deal. And oil traders were like, okay, that's enough for me. Sell oil futures. How many times have we seen this? We've been saying that this particular flare-up in the conflict was unusual. Usually this happens on Friday, and then by Sunday we make a deal. Now it happened on a Tuesday, and apparently by Thursday someone wants to make a deal. So we'll see. We'll probably get the denial from the Iranian government that that phone call ever took place within the next few minutes. It may have happened already. I'm sure that'll be posted pretty soon. Now, as all this is going on, we have this article in India about cooking gas surplus. And this article just has me like throwing papers up in the air saying, what the hell is really going on in energy markets? Because there have been dozens of articles about how India was running out of LPG, liquid petroleum, or whatever LPG is. It's their favorite cooking gas. Don't quote me on the acronym. But they were running out of it because they get it all from the Strait of Hormuz, and they were doing all of these price controls and all of these rationing methods. And now all of a sudden they've got a surplus. They're even talking about importers paying fines because the tanks were full and they had to turn away boats that they had ordered. I don't know who to believe in the energy markets. And that's one of the reasons why I'm just staying out of energy markets. It's a mess. You've got these massive narratives where we go from, oh, the world will run out of oil in 48 hours to the tanks are full and we're paying a fine to turn away imports. So who's right here? I don't know. And so I'm just staying out and I'm just observing. Meanwhile, closer to home, we got Pepsi earnings missed expectations this morning. Kind of interesting. Price cuts, not enough to juice sales for Pepsi. Their revenue was down 2% year over year on flat revenue. This is after Pepsi cut prices on some of their salty snacks by up to 15%. You know, the whole solution to higher prices is higher prices thing. Not enough to sustain those volumes. They were only flat. Well, they were enough to sustain volumes, not enough to increase those volumes. And of course, with prices lowered, revenue is down. So Pepsi stock has taken a hit this morning. The owner of that office building in Manhattan that nearly collapsed, the old Pfizer building, he says that they are going to rebuild the 15 floors that they built on top of the old building. And they didn't shore up the supports enough. This just in, when you add 15 floors to a building, you better make it stronger at the bottom. What brilliant engineering analysis that was. This guy's going to go bankrupt. It's only a matter of time. I'm sure within the next couple of weeks we'll hear about this guy filing for bankruptcy. Who knows what kind of fines he's going to pay. But you don't just tear down 15 floors that you just built and then put another 15 floors back on top of it when you're already up to your eyeballs in debt on an office building that you're having trouble leasing out. Also, you can put apartments on there in New York City. No, he's done for. PCE is getting a makeover at the Federal Reserve, and they're saying that's going to provide the Fed with some relief from inflation, and that's encouraging. It's not going to do anything for you or me. It's not going to change what we're actually paying at the store. It's just going to change how we measure inflation and therefore make inflation not look like as big of a problem. And then maybe there will be less pressure to increase interest rates on Kevin Warsh. So what's the problem? The gauge isn't telling us what we want it to tell them. So, okay, do we adjust our behavior? Do we change monetary policy? Or do we just change the gauge? We just rig the gauge. That's what they're doing at the Fed. And last but not least, we got to talk about these two articles this morning about shortages in the data center build out. You know, we're going to have some AI articles today, right? These shortages that are affecting the data center build out. No, I'm not talking about power. I'm not talking about water. I'm talking about people and I'm talking about money. They're coming up short. Not memory either. No, it's people and it's money. That's holding back data centers this morning. We'll talk about those two articles, but wait till you hear where they're going to get the money from. This is interesting. You'll never guess. Yeah, you'll guess. But you'll never guess where they're going to get the money from. Guys, we got a lot to talk about this morning. Why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance. Don't forget the like button and the subscribe button for the YouTube algorithm so you can come back tomorrow and have your coffee with the melon heads because we do this every business day. And right now, stocks are a little bit higher ahead of the opening bell, 19 points to the upside for the S&P 500, a little more than a quarter percent in the green. We've got the Dow is higher by 85 points or 0.16% to the upside as well. And the NASDAQ is up by 268 points, 0.92% higher. Tech stocks leading the way this morning. Looking over at the DXY, we've got the dollars modestly weaker this morning, below 101, sitting here at 100.98. Looking over at the bond market, we've got interest rates are higher on the long end, lower on the short end. 30-year yield is at 5.084. That's higher by 2 points and change. The 10-year yield is at 4.571. That's higher by a fraction of a point. 10 years getting awfully close to 4.6 here. The 2-year yield is at 4.191. That's lower by 1 basis point. And the 1 month is at 3.618. That's off by a point and change. Looking over at Bitcoin, we are a little bit higher this morning, up by about $520, $62,759 for Bitcoin as priced on Coinbase. Looking over at the commodities board, we've got metals are liking things this morning. Spot gold, $4,115. That's higher by 38 bucks or 0.94% in the green. Spot silver is at $59.59, higher by $1.30. or 2.2% higher. I like the shiny. Copper's higher by 2.1%. Platinum's up by 2.5%. Palladium's up by 2.6%. And crude oil is now up by about 24 cents. It was a little bit lower a few minutes ago. Now it's higher by not even a quarter here, 0.3%. $73.75 a barrel for WTI crude. We'll talk about energy in just a moment. Well, let's talk about it now, shall we? Hormuz shipping grinds to near halt after U.S. and Iran strikes. Traffic through the Strait of Hormuz came to a near standstill on Thursday after the U.S. struck Iran for a second straight day as the fragile truce between the two sides looked increasingly shaky. Why are we still talking about this truce like it even freaking exists? Oh, the fragile truce is beginning to look shaky. What was your first clue? The freaking missiles crisscrossing each other in the sky on their way to blowing shit up on the ground in both countries? Yeah, I'd say it's awful fragile, awful shaky. It's almost like the ceasefire or the truce doesn't exist. As a matter of fact, we've been shooting at each other this whole time. It's almost like it never existed to begin with. We all just kind of pretended, and somehow that was enough to drop the price of oil by like 40 bucks a barrel. Observable movements in the world's most vital energy conduit largely occurred along an Iran-approved route near the waterways north, while the U.S.-supported Omani corridor was quiet, ship tracking data shows. Among larger vessels, only a U.S.-sanctioned supertanker heading out of the Persian Gulf was seen in the strait alongside an Iranian-flagged container ship. Some vessels crossed on Wednesday with their transponders turned off. An India-flagged supertanker that had aborted an earlier attempt to transit Hormuz reappeared in the Gulf of Oman on Thursday, indicating it had made the crossing in the dark. A UAE-linked bulk carrier did the same, resurfacing off Fujairah on Thursday, according to vessel tracking data compiled by Bloomberg. As the war has gone on, it's become increasingly evident that some oil tankers have been sailing through Hormuz with their transponders off to lower the risk of attack by Iranian forces. With three attacks on big oil and gas tankers this week, it's very possible that the practice has resumed. Information about those dark transits takes several days to emerge. Oh, but don't worry, guys, because Trump says Iran called to make a deal after U.S. strikes and adds it's unclear if war is back on. Well, let me clarify. War is back on because we're killing each other again. All right. That's not really open to interpretation, in my opinion. Are you bombing YN? If Y, then war on. If N, truce on. All right, why is this so complicated? That being said, President Trump says thing and oil prices fall, right? Because, oh yeah, Iran called. They want to make a deal. Not who when Iran called. Was it some guy? Was it Bob, the Iranian cab driver, who called and said, let's make a deal? And then Trump goes on Air Force One and says, oh, they really want to make a deal. And there was also a whole bunch of other blustery stuff that he said, but that was basically it. And that was enough to move oil prices lower on that news, $73.39 a barrel. Now, this chart on TradingView is showing WTI down by $1.40 at 73.35. The Commodities Board is showing it same level here. So, yeah, President Trump says thing and oil falls. That's the headline there. All right. Now, back to what's going on in the actual tanks. And this is why it's so hard to really sort out the FUD from the facts and what is the actual energy inventory look like here. Because India was, up to a few weeks ago, just desperate for fuel, buying anything, doing whatever they can to get their hands at rationing, price controls. And then we get this article today. India's wartime buying spree leaves behind a cooking gas surplus. Okay, how did we go from a dearth to a surplus in just a matter of days? I don't know, but I'm just reading what the article says here. India's frenzied efforts to counter disruptions in cooking gas supplies over the past months, while cargoes remain trapped in the Persian Gulf, has left state-run fuel retailers with the opposite problem, more than they can sell. The three refiners run by the government, including India's biggest processor, Indian Oil Corp, has booked liquefied petroleum gas supplies amounting to as much as 40,000 tons per day, according to people familiar with the situation. I wonder if they're related to the people familiar with the matter. I don't know. Maybe they're distant cousins. The daily import requirement now, however, is closer to 30,000 tons to 32,000 tons. So they're importing 40,000 a day when they only need 30 to 32. Yep, that's a surplus, all right. Part of the drop is explained by a boost in production from state processors themselves, which lifted output by more than two-thirds to 54,000 tons a day after the near total closure of the Strait of Hormuz crimped shipments. Daily production has since been scaled back to about 40,000 tons, the people said, asking not to be named. But demand has also been slower to recover, especially when it comes to large consumers such as restaurants or industrial outfits, such as ceramic tile manufacturers, who switched to alternative fuels like pipe gas during the supply crisis. Consumption in June was about 73,000 tons a day, compared with 91,000 tons average in the year ended March. Remember, I've been talking for the last couple of days. There is some massive amount of demand destruction happening somewhere. It's the only explanation for how the world hasn't run out of oil. Well, here's a big one here. You had consumption of this LPG was 91,000 tons up until March, and now it's 73,000 tons a day. Yeah, that's a massive decline in consumption of LPG in India. At the height of the war, refiners bought more than they required, the people said, as they feared some of those cargoes would not be delivered. However, all these volumes are now arriving in the country after an interim peace deal with the U.S. and Iran helped restart some flows through the strait for several weeks. Of course, those flows are now zero again. Disruptions have since resumed, but are yet to be felt in India. At least one of the state refiners had to pay a penalty charges to a ship owner after discharge of its LPG cargo was delayed because storage tanks were full. Again, this whipsaw, this back and forth volatility, we were going from shortage to surplus, back to shortage day in and day out. It's really hard to know what's what in the energy market these days. All right, now on to those European car producers. Porsche's first half sales slide to weakest in 6 years. And again, you're not going to get really any weaker than that 6 year ago number because that was at the height of COVID when it was pretty much illegal to buy a car or like wipe your face or sneeze in Europe at that point in time. Porsche deliveries slumped 16% in the first half, dragged down by weak demand in its biggest market of North America and a decline of nearly a third in China, adding to the gloom enveloping Germany's auto sector. Now, one thing I want to point out right away in this first paragraph, all right, the gloom in China, nearly a third, that's directly in line with what we saw from Mercedes yesterday. Right? Mercedes saw, I think it was a 30% drop in their Chinese sales. So we're seeing the same thing with Porsche. However, Mercedes had mentioned strength in the North American market yesterday that had partially offset that China number. But they're talking about here weak demand in its biggest market of North America. So Porsche is doing even worse than Mercedes because for some reason Americans are buying Mercedes and not Porsches right now. Now Porsche is probably a little higher up on the quality ladder than Mercedes, right? Mercedes is a high-end car. Porsche is, you know, obviously even higher than that. But that struck me as one noticeable difference between the two headlines that were just a day apart. Now, back on the Porsche, sales dipped to 122,306 in January to June period, the German manufacturer said on Thursday, the lowest level since 2020. It recorded fewer deliveries in all regions, with North America dropping by 13% and China by 32%. Porsche said the main reasons for the overall decline included the end of production of the combustion engine 718 model, strong demand last year for the all-electric Macan, and the expiry of U.S. tax incentives for electric and hybrid vehicles. The decline is starkest in China, where a property crisis and tougher local competition are curbing demand for high-end vehicles for Mercedes-Benz, BMW, and Porsche. The latter has been downsizing its dealer network in the country and is working to offer in-car software that better fits local tastes. The maker of the 911 sports car is forecasting its sales there to decline for a fifth consecutive year. Again, sales dropped by nearly a third in China for Porsche. And things are even worse for Volkswagen, who owns three-quarters of Porsche, by the way. Union to protest as Volkswagen thrashes out job cut plans. German auto giant Volkswagen's management to meet Thursday to thrash out plans for what could be the biggest ever restructuring in the global auto industry, with unions set to protest any mass job cuts. Europe's largest car maker has come under intense pressure from U.S. tariffs, slimmer profit margins from electric cars, and above all else, competition in China, the world's largest auto market. Volkswagen, whose 10 brands range from mass market seats to premium Porsches, is already in the process of axing 50,000 jobs in Germany by 2030, including 35,000 at its namesake marquee. The cuts at the Volkswagen brand are part of a deal reached with unions at the end of 2024, which also ruled out plant closures in Germany until at least the end of this decade. Okay, 50,000 jobs, no plant closures. That was then, 2024. But CEO Oliver Blume is now eyeing cutting 100,000 jobs worldwide, as well as the closure of three German Volkswagen plants and an Audi factory, Weekly Manager magazine reported, citing company sources. If these plans come to fruition, we would stop them with all our might, said Christian Benner, head of the powerful IG Metall union, in a joint statement with Volkswagen Works Council Chief Daniela Cavallo. IG Metall is organizing protests by Volkswagen workers outside plants across the country Thursday, when the carmaker's bosses will present the restructuring plan to the supervisory board. Now, this is important. They do things differently in Europe. This supervisory board ultimately makes the call, and the supervisory board is made up 50-50 of shareholders and labor representatives, union representatives. So they've got to get this past the union in order to make this happen. Our business model of the past decade no longer works, said the CEO in a March letter, citing regional market conditions, changes in trade policy, massive regulatory requirements in the various regions of the world, and our high-cost production, above all in Europe. Higher U.S. tariffs on cars and auto parts introduced last year are expected to cost Volkswagen 5 billion euros or $5.7 billion annually, Blume said in June, with the situation particularly acute at Audi and Porsche. Higher U.S. tariffs on cars and auto parts introduced last year are expected to cost Okay, I already said that. Volkswagen is also being elbowed out of China, with years of declining sales amid stiff local competition last year, leaving the firm's vehicle deliveries in the country at their lowest level since 2011. The cars that are being sold in China, some of them are the world's best, said Tu Li, founder of Sino Auto Insights. The fall for the German automakers has been really abrupt. So we saw that yesterday, that the Chinese exports increased 150% year over year because they just made too many of them. And there's just nobody buying European cars in China. Things aren't going so well in North America. Cost of doing business in Europe, throw tariffs on top of that. These companies are in big trouble here. And now we're looking at possibly six-figure job cuts. Again, the company's probably highballing here, that 100,000 job cut number that they're throwing around. They're probably throwing that out there, hoping to get something closer to 75 when the union already agreed to 50. Meanwhile, Pepsi earnings, they say the tightening shopper budget hit U.S. snack sales. Pepsi stock not doing so hot this morning. PepsiCo said consumers pulled back in the second quarter, slowing its efforts to revitalize its North American snack business. The maker of Doritos, Lay's, and Gatorade saw a 2% decline in revenue in its North American food business and flat volume after taking action earlier this year to cut prices by as much as 15% in some brands. And, well, let's just stop and appreciate here what we're talking about, a 15% price cut for some brands. It's not every day we hear about the price of food products going down. So, hey, there's some good news there. And again, the good news is partially offset by the fact that they're being forced to do this because prices went up so much people can no longer afford to buy their stuff. Results were tempered in the quarter as U.S. food and beverage category performance moderated, with consumer budgets tightening due to rising inflationary pressures, CEO Ramon LaGuardia said in prepared remarks on Thursday. So cutting prices, it took a chunk out of revenue, down 2% year over year, but volumes flat. Pepsi not doing so hot this morning, down 3.8% year over year, this morning ahead of the opening bell, $137.10, off by $5.39. Year to date, Pepsi is now negative for the year, albeit only by a fraction of a percent. Over the last year, it's still up about 5.5%. It's been a hard time for the consumer staples. And again, this is one of those names, Pepsi. They're not doing so hot right now, but this is the kind of name that is on my recession shopping list. If we do see a big correction in markets due to the bursting of the AI bubble or some kind of other liquidity crisis happening, these are the kind of names that would get dragged down with everything else that I'd be looking to buy up on the cheap. Back to commercial real estate. We've got that damaged Manhattan Tower owner to reconstruct 15 floors after evacuation. The developer behind the Midtown Manhattan Tower that was evacuated over structural concerns on Tuesday said it has a plan to fix the issue, including reconstructing 15 floors that were added to the original building as part of its conversion into apartments. Well, if it was really expensive to convert an office building into apartments before, well, doing it twice isn't going to make that any better. The height of the tower's 21st floor, which is taller than others at 235 East 42nd Street, made two columns more susceptible to load, said Nathan Berman, CEO of developer Metro Loft. Those columns weren't sufficiently reinforced, leading them to bend and causing some of the 15 cantilevered floors above to sag. Metro Loft now plans to replace the facade, slabs, and steel on those floors. In other words, they're going to tear those floors off and rebuild them. We are prepared to rebuild that portion of the building, Berman said in an interview. It will be reskinned, everything will be leveled, fixed in place, and it will be brand new. And you can kind of see in this picture here, look at the picture of this beam. Yikes. Is that a good thing when you see I-beams bending that much and then just outright cracking in the middle? Yeah, maybe just want to throw a coat of paint on that one while you're at it. The damage at the tower, the former headquarters of Pfizer, has highlighted the engineering challenges of office conversions, a strategy embraced by developers and officials, including Mayor Zohran Mamdani, as a way to address New York's housing shortage. This developer is going to end up filing for bankruptcy. Meanwhile, wars to get some inflation relief from upcoming PCE makeover. That's right. When the inflation stats don't say what you want them to say, just change the stats, and then all of a sudden inflation doesn't look so bad anymore. A coming revamp of the Federal Reserve's preferred inflation gauge could be just enough to tip the scales against interest rate increases this year, even if it doesn't dramatically alter the overall picture on prices. That's the early assessment from economists running the numbers on an annual update of the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index that is due in September from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. I just want to point out, guys, this is an annual update. They do this every year. It's not a new thing. The new guy isn't coming in and changing everything, although he might also do that. You know, they have a task force that's looking into the way they measure inflation. But it is worth pointing out, like, they do this every year, and every year it makes the numbers worse. When's the last time they did one of these annual updates and it made inflation seem worse than it is? This is one of the ways that they rob you by misreporting how much prices are really going up. Several said the plan changes would have likely lowered core inflation anywhere from 1/10 to nearly 3/10 of a percentage point if they'd already been applied to the latest data. The PCE price index rose 4.1% in May from a year earlier, the most since April of 2023. And far above the U.S. Central Bank's 2% target. The core PCE reading, which policymakers lean on, given it excludes volatile food and energy, rose by 3.4%. Fed officials were nearly unanimous in the last policy meeting in June that risks to the inflation outlook remain to the upside. But given how evenly split they were on the need for a rate hike in 2026, a downward revision to PCE at just the right time could help new Fed Chairman Kevin Warsh and the Doves hold the line. The case for the Fed remaining on hold has strengthened substantially said Stephanie Roth, the chief economist at Wolf Research. In addition to the planned PCE update, she also pointed to the recent slump in oil prices from the height of the Iran war in April and May, and the latest jobs report, which showed momentum in the labor market over the last few months, may have been overstated. As of right now, the likelihood of the Fed hiking rates at some point over the remainder of this year sits at about 84% versus roughly 16% chance that they leave rates where they are. There's currently no chance of any rate cuts priced in. You got a 38% chance that they hike once, a 33% chance they hike twice, 12% chance they hike three times, and even 1.5% chance of four rate hikes versus just 15.5% that they stay here. So maybe they change PCE and then they're like, nah, we don't have to raise rates. Sure, it's not going to change things for you or me, but it makes Kevin Warsh's job easier, and I'm sure that's going to help us all sleep better at night. All right, now we got to talk about data centers and the shortages. Not memory, not water, not electricity. Nope. People and money. First, let's talk about people. Labor shortages are putting a bug in the data center build. Contractors like Sterling Infrastructure and Comfort Systems USA have more work than they have skilled labor for. The data center boom has been touted as the economy's new growth machine, a way to lift businesses and swell local tax coffers. But after straining electric grids, pushing up utility bills, and raising worries over water supply and pollution, data centers are running into a more basic problem. There aren't enough people to build them. After a blockbuster earnings stretch, contractors like Sterling Infrastructure and Comfort Systems USA that supply skilled labor for data centers are hitting a bottleneck. There's plenty more work we could take if we could possibly do it, said Comfort Systems Chief Financial Officer William George. For all the futuristic promise of AI, its physical footprint still depends on a very human supply chain. The combined project backlogs at Comfort Systems, EMCOR, and Sterling Infrastructure have surged sixfold, far more than the increase in U.S. employment of craft workers like electricians and HVAC installers. We'll look at this chart in just a second. The crunch is rooted in construction's ongoing problems, a graying workforce, too few young recruits, and a thin pipeline of apprenticeships, community college programs, and early trade training. And immigration crackdowns haven't helped, as foreign-born workers make up a third of the construction trade's workforce. Some graduates locked out of white-collar jobs are starting to drift towards the trades, but that won't rewire the AI economy overnight. Blue-collar stigma still runs deep, and training takes years, leaving one of America's hottest growth stories dependent on an old-school workforce problem. That just bugs the hell out of me, that blue-collar stigma thing. Why is there a stigma on blue-collar work? We have such a shortage of it. It's so hard to get good work done on your place anymore. I mean, you'd think we'd have a bigger stigma on not working than we do on blue-collar work, but apparently not. But just to go to show you, this is the chart from that Bloomberg article. What they're showing at here is these three companies, Comfort, EMCOR, and Sterling. This is the size of their building backlog in billions of dollars. You can see it's gone from about $5 billion throughout the 20-teens to up to almost $35 billion now. Even over that same time period, though, their workforce has been largely stagnant. It's actually the workforce at these companies has fallen over the last 12 months. That's probably your immigration and retirement showing there. So how are they going to build all this stuff with the same number of people? The easy answer, guys, is they're not going to build it. It's going to take forever. And that's probably one of the reasons why we're hearing how more than half of these data center projects are being delayed. And yet NVIDIA keeps booking the revenue on the chips. They're just putting them in the warehouse, booking the revenue. They haven't actually been paid. They haven't actually shipped them. They're just holding on to them for the customers. Oh, I'm sure that's not going to end in a massive restatement of earnings someday. Yeah, but I digress. All right, now let's talk about the other shortage. Capital, money. Where are they going to get the money to build all this stuff? BlackRock sees private credit taking a bigger role in the AI build-out. Private credit is poised to take an even bigger role in financing the massive amount of infrastructure investment for artificial intelligence as companies look for capital to fund outsized expenditures, according to the head of BlackRock's research arm. We are in, you know, a global transformation like we probably have never seen before, said BlackRock's Gene Boivin Tuesday in an interview on Bloomberg Television. The world will have to leverage up as a result. Leveraging up comes with risk, you think? that would need to be managed, but there's no real alternative to really build out the AI or the global infrastructure that are needed to get to a place where we're going to require more funding. I just love this. I love it. If only there were signs, right? We're talking about private credit here, which has kind of had its issues over the last few months, you may recall. There's look at the way this guy talks. We're in, you know, like this transformation thing, my dude. The world is going to have to leverage up. Oh, yes. The world's going to have to leverage up. That never caused problems before, massive amounts of leverage upon leverage. It's not like we're already hopelessly levered up to begin with, right? No, we need more leverage in the private credit space to build more data centers that don't make any money. Thanks, Gene. His endorsement of the role of private credit comes at a time of rising concern over potential froth in an explosive market, you think? Bloomberg Intelligence projects that capital expenditures for the six largest U.S. hyperscalers will reach nearly $820 billion this year, up almost 80% from 2025's then record levels. Bovin said the quickening pace of the AI buildout creates competing narratives of abundance versus scarcity across the economy. Companies' capital needs are so vast, they will have to borrow just about everywhere. This scenario creates a big tailwind for private credit, Bovin said. The space, the asset class, I think is going to be positioned for playing an even bigger role. All right, so private credit is where we're going to get the hundreds of billions of dollars. Let's just overlook the fact that for the last 6 months, everyone and their brother has been trying to get their money out of private credit, and private credit has been telling them no, but somehow they're going to come up with hundreds of billions, dare I say trillions of dollars, to keep funding this data center build-out, where even if they do manage to come up with the money, we just got done talking about how they don't have the people to build this stuff, not to mention memory, water, and power, and not to mention the fact that none of this stuff makes any money for anyone. That's kind of an important detail. Isn't it? Isn't that important? Anybody, some of you guys in the back, isn't the point of business to make money? Thank you. Thank you. I just sanity check there. Yes, the point of business is to make money, and data centers don't make money. The people who sell the guts of the data centers are making money hand over fist, so much so that they're giving that money right back to their customers so they can keep buying their stuff in the biggest accounting fraud in history. But yeah, nobody's making any money. And now private credit, the sector of the economy where people can't get their money out fast enough, somehow that's going to come up with the hundreds of billions needed to finance this thing. Sure, Jan, have fun with that one. Hey, guys, that's all I got for you this morning. I just want to say thank you very much for having your coffee with the Melonheads. Don't forget the like button and the subscribe button for the algorithm. Thank you very much to my magnanimous Melonhead supporters on Patreon, YouTube members, and Buy Me a Coffee for supporting the channel. All those links are down there should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.